happened was we were saying just before that you have officially left Iron Maiden.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I quit, probably a year and a half ago. I actually, you know, pulled in Rod, who's my manager and still my manager, you know. And I played him some of the stuff I've been tinkering around with, because I recorded like two entire albums of material, all different stuff, before starting to record Balls to Picasso even. So, I mean, I was really in a whole big process of trying to find out what it was that I wanted to do. And the decision to leave Iron Maiden was it was a difficult one, but it didn't take that long.
What about the fans? Were you worried about whether you'd have the support of the fans as well?
Well, really, yeah, in a way I was. I always intended to go out and do my own thing and be myself, because I don't want to be a clone of Bruce Dickinson or Paul Di'Anno or anybody else, for that matter. So I've got to do it my own way and be myself. But the only thing that the fans have said to me, all the people that I've met, is good luck and yeah, congratulations and well done, you know. And standing alone in the wind and rain.
Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ, and we have arrived at what will be my second to last episode in my series on Iron Maiden. And we've made it to the point in the band's history where Bruce Dickinson has left. He left after the Fear of the Dark tour, and it wasn't the most amicable split, but it opened the door for Wolfsbane frontman Blaze Bayley to step through. Blaze officially joined the band at the very end of 1993. Apparently an ill-timed motorcycle accident complicated things, and it wouldn't be until October of 1995 that Iron Maiden's first album with Blaze on vocals was released, an album called The X Factor, a thinly veiled reference to the fact that it was the band's 10th studio album. In March of 1998, the band's second and last album with Blaze, Virtual XI, which kept the Roman numeral theme going, but it's pronounced Virtual 11, apparently. That album was released in March of 1998, and by the year 2000, Bruce Dickinson and Adrian Smith were back in Iron Maiden, and Blaze was out. So when I was putting this whole Iron Maiden series together, and I came to the point of deciding what exactly to do with the Blaze Bayley era, the obvious, if not ambitious, thing to do seemed to be to ask Blaze himself to speak with me about his time with the band and the two albums that they made together, and he graciously agreed, so here we are. On today's episode, my special guest will be Blaze Bayley himself to discuss The X Factor and Virtual 11. Blaze was in a Starbucks while he spoke with me, so there's a lot of background noise, but hopefully that won't inhibit your enjoyment of the episode, because he was a very, very nice guy and had a lot to say. So let's get to it. This is the conversation I had with the man himself, Blaze Bayley. Find him at blazebayley.net. Go click like on his Facebook page. He's very active on there. And Blaze Bayley has continued to make a lot of cool music since leaving Iron Maiden, with Wolfsbane and with his band Blaze, and solo. Lots of power metal, heavy stuff he's done. Some really melodic stuff. But for now, let's talk to Blaze about his time with Iron Maiden.
We'll be right back. Well, so I read a quote from you where you said that when Wolfsbane, when you opened for Maiden in, on the 1990 British tour, you said it was your mission to destroy Bruce every night.
Yeah, that is the bold, boastful ambition of a young, inexperienced man with a lot of confidence verging on stupidity, because nobody's really going to destroy Bruce Dickinson. But that was the attitude that I had going into that tour, was I really want to try and steal the crowd. Nobody can do that to Iron Maiden, because they have such a catalogue of fantastic songs and so many loyal fans. But even so, that's what we tried to do. I don't think we were arrogant, but we were confident that with the energy that we had in Wolfsbane and our presentation, in that we looked at the fans and we talked to the fans and we were there for the fans, that we could certainly be one of the better support bands that Iron Maiden had had. And our goal was to obviously try and impress those fans, because Iron Maiden fans, just, you know, they're loyal heavy metal fans, and if they like you, then they're going to stay with you. And we wanted to really impress those people and say, look, please get interested in our music, we'd really like your support. And we thought if we went out every night and gave absolutely everything we had, put that into those 40 minutes, then we might get somewhere. And that proved to be true. We did. And the fans really took to us on the tour. And it was, I think it was 31 sold-out shows in UK venues, which is impossible to do now for almost anybody. And it was just fantastic. It was the best tour of my life, really.
Really?
Absolutely, yeah. It's hard to top that. Being a support band for Iron Maiden, and we went on and, you know, we sang that bit of Heaven Can Wait, and then I could, in London, I went on and sang Daughter to the Slaughter with Bruce, and he gave me the mic for some of the time as well and left me with the crowd. It was just fantastic time, and Steve asked me to join the football team, so every Saturday there was a game of football and I was on the team. It was just absolutely fantastic, man. I travelled a lot with Steve Harris as well and got to know him really well. Such a lovely, lovely guy. And it was just the best tour. And when that tour ended, I was so depressed. I was absolutely, you know, gutted. I just wanted to carry on, because that was like a door, a legitimate door that had opened for Wolfsbane. And it really felt like we could do something, and it was the start of something. And then nothing happened, really. The record company dropped the ball. We took advice, which we didn't think was right, but we think, well, you know, these people are supposedly older and wiser than we are, but we just wanted to carry on touring after that. And we thought, well, we've got this little bit of a name now as an Iron Maiden support band. Maybe that'll be enough, that if we keep touring now, we can really build on that. And we didn't. They said, I'll go away and make a next album. And by the time we came back with that album, it was the days of grunge and our chance was over.
Yeah, right. Well, I was wondering if, when you were on that 1990 tour, if you could already tell at that point that maybe there were issues within the band, or that Bruce, maybe his heart
really
wasn't in it as much, or...
No, not at all. No, because we didn't know them personally.
Yeah.
We didn't know them that well. You know, I was an Iron Maiden fan, and I'd seen two of the tours in recent times, but I couldn't tell, really. It was, you know, and everybody travelled because it was the UK. When they had the opportunity, everybody liked to go home.
Right.
You know, if they had a day off the next day or whatever. So really, I couldn't see it. There was no chat about that. Just, yeah, you couldn't tell that there was anything like that going on. And they're very professional about the way they handled things. And certainly from a performance point of view, you couldn't tell. And one of the things that Steve Harris did say, though, on that tour, was it's nice to have a band that will give us a run for our money, that will have a go, because there were absolutely no restrictions to where I could go on stage, apart from you don't touch the drum riser, you don't touch anything that's covered. But I could climb up the sides of the speakers, I could go on the PA just like Bruce did. There were absolutely no limits to what I could do. There was no paranoia from Iron Maiden that somebody's going to blow them away. They just used to watch me and laugh, think, look, you know, look at that lunatic. He's going to fall off any minute. And I thought that was such a sign of confidence. And I'm so graceful about it. And I think it really, Steve thought, well, if Bruce sees me doing anything, if that, Bruce will start to get competitive. So I don't know if that happened. But I think that may have been an edge to it. But I could go anywhere and do anything, climb on anything. Nothing was off limits apart from their stage set. And it was just absolutely fantastic. We went crazy every night.
Yeah, I mean, I love Wolfsbane, and I think you were such a cool and interesting band from that time period. You know, kind of when what people call hair metal was very popular, and there were so many bands that were just kind of imitating each other. But, you know, you were just a killer rock band that kind of could have come from any era. And so your records don't sound dated or anything like some of the rest of those albums do from that time.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, we didn't use any trendy sounds.
Right. Well, and what seems to have set you apart, you could hear a punk rock influence in your music too, which you didn't really hear in most of those other bands. But that's funny because that's kind of the same thing that happened with Iron Maiden when they started out. There was a real kind of a punk rock influence, especially in the Paul Di'Anno era. So I thought that was kind of, there was kind of a similarity there with Wolfsbane and Maiden with the punk elements that most of the peers of both bands didn't really incorporate, you know?
There was certainly an edge and an urgency to what we did. And there was a punk rock influence musically, particularly from Jeff Hatley and the bass player and from me, because, you know, the Sex Pistols were in the charts when I was at school. And the cover band at school played punk covers. And Jeff Hatley was a massive fan of The Damned, MC5, and the Sex Pistols, you know, going right back. So we certainly had that edge to us. And those were, well, they felt like almost contemporaries of what we were doing. And we had this do-it-yourself attitude that many punk rock bands have as well. So that was certainly there. And then we had the sensibilities that we were influenced, you know, by Van Halen and some of the American bands, as well as the European bands. So it was a broad spectrum there.
Yeah, well, you say Van Halen. I mean, Live Fast, Die Fast with that minimalist Rick Rubin production. I think that album sounds so much like Van Halen. You sound like David Lee Roth on that record, too. There really is a huge Van Halen feel on
that
album.
Yeah, there is, yeah.
Believe.
Diamond Dave was a big influence on me at the time, because he was the larger than life character. He was the front man, not the singer. And I kind of liked the attitude that you'd be on there putting the songs over, was just as important as singing the songs. And that was the attitude I had at the time. And it seemed to work for us. We just never toured enough. That's the only thing, you know, that we just never had the opportunity to do what we did in the UK. We toured everywhere in the UK before we were signed up. We never had that opportunity in America, and we never had it in Europe. So the thing that we did in the UK, where you could get close up and personal with people, and that energy could really come over, and those, the catchiness of the songs and the passion could really come over, we never had the opportunity. And so that's why we never really, all of us think in the band, that's why we really never got to that next step, is just, when it came to it, the way that the business was set up at the time, and the record business and the music business, people would pay more money to go on tour than they actually made on the tour. And it's just a ridiculous business thing, you know, that never, just does not happen anymore. But those were the days when it did. So people would look at you going on tour and go, well, that's going to cost a lot of money. But in reality, we were so cheap. We just loved to live on the tour bus. That's it. We didn't need hotels. We didn't need nothing. If we were on that bus with a few cans of beer and a gig to go to, we were just so happy, man. We were pigs in chocolate. So that's why, really, we never got... We always felt we were good enough. And we always felt that musically we had a lot to say. But we just never made it to that next step. And I think we just, you know, we just didn't... We weren't exposed to enough people. We certainly weren't a video band. We weren't great looking. But we were this great, live, energetic, urgent band that people loved.
Yeah, well, like you talked about how you thought putting the song across was just as important as the singing. But, of course, the era that you were in was when the whole grunge alternative attitude was that you're not supposed to be a rock star and be a performer. So, yeah,
that's what happened.
Yeah,
that's what we just fell into that era. That was, you know, but fashion changes.
Yeah,
that, you know, that was a fashion. We weren't really fashionable at all. You know, we were in that spirit of the classic rock band that just hardly changes, and just in that Aerosmith kind of AC/DC thing. We had Motorhead. Those were the bands that, when we thought about image, we were who we were. You know, the clothes that we wore on stage are basically the clothes that we wore the rest of the time. And we weren't a million miles apart in attitude from those grunge bands, but their attitude absolutely stunk to us, because they were nothing about the fans. They didn't seem to place any importance, or they didn't care that they had fans. It seemed such a negative attitude, and we were all about the fans, and because we were fans ourselves, you know. So, yeah, it's weird, but, you know, that's fashion. It goes around, and I think the style of music that we did as Wolfsbane, it may have gone down, but it came back around, and I don't think grunge ever will. You know, it'll come. There's been some kind of pop punk incarnations now, which have taken bits from grunge, but that attitude, I don't think that can come back.
Yeah, no, and there's none of the kind of nostalgia and just love for that kind of music the way it still is for hard rock and heavy metal.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, we're listening to music from 30 and 40 years ago, and guys, school age, you know, men and women at college and at school are discovering songs from 30 or 40 years ago, and they feel new. They still have a vibrancy and energy to them. Those first Led Zeppelin albums and all of that, the first Sabbath album, still have a mystery and something about them that makes them valid today.
Right. But of course, by the early 90s, Iron Maiden had, you know, we talked about the punk influence, but by the 90s, they had morphed into a very different kind of band. And I only see it from the American perspective, but in the U.S., Iron Maiden's career had definitely been in decline, I guess starting with Seventh Son, but especially No Prayer for the Dying, and then Fear of the Dark didn't even go gold. So, you know, but I guess in the rest of the world, they were bigger than ever with Fear of the Dark. So
no,
it's kind of a...
No, I don't think they were bigger than ever. They were still the same. Nothing had really changed.
Right.
With Fear of the Dark. I think No Prayer for the Dying was the low point in just the amount of songs on that. I think that was one where, looking back now, then you can see that the performance on there for Bruce was well below his capability. And I don't think that is the performance. No Prayer for the Dying. I don't think Bruce would ever get that out and say, hey, listen to one of my great vocal performances on an album.
Yeah.
You know, whereas I think he could say that about Seventh Son, all the albums up to then, and certain parts of Fear of the Dark as well. But I think that's the change, the popularity, I think, in the US, the Maiden is as a beast in itself, very resistant to changing anything. And which is a good thing, because they do it their own way. And that's why, as fans, we love them, because they have their own soul and their own way of doing things. But I think because of the changes and the way the business was changing in the West, that they didn't like it over there. Whereas in the rest of Europe, people don't really care how old you are, how long you've been going. People see the name and they know it. And they think if that's been around a long time, then apart from in the UK, everywhere else in Europe, they go, oh, they must be worth watching if they've lasted this long. Because in the UK, we're slightly more like the US in that way. It's like, oh, they've been around that long. Oh, they're probably old and tired and boring. But you don't get that in the rest of Europe. So by the time I joined the band, we were being slagged off in the UK as Maiden is past it, they're past the best. But we were playing to 10,000 people every night in Spain. We were playing full everywhere. We sold out the stadiums in Paris, France. And with me in the band, Iron Maiden became bigger in Scandinavia than they'd ever been before, because that X Factor album was something that had a particular resonance with the Scandinavian fans. And now, even now, that album, many people that I meet in Scandinavia say, my favourite Iron Maiden album is The X Factor. It's the darkest album Iron Maiden ever did. And so it was a change, I think. That when I came in with that X Factor, it was a radical change. It was a shift. And I think Steve Harris is the main songwriter. And I think what had influenced him in that time was he really wanted to work with a different voice. And I was so enthusiastic and, you know, about working with Steve Harris and Yannick Gers, and I was so positive about all of that. I think he saw that was a breath of fresh air to him, that somebody actually wanted to be in the band, wanted to do well. I believed in the band. I believed in Iron Maiden 100%. And because I've been a fan of the band for so many years, I knew why fans liked the band. And I think that's something that perhaps some of the people in the band didn't know why people liked Iron Maiden. They had their idea, but I felt I really knew why fans loved Iron Maiden. And that was because they were not going to compromise with anybody about anything, and they were always going to play the music that they wanted to play, no matter what, commercial or not. That's what they were going to do, and that's why I loved them, and I thought that's why other fans loved them as well. And I think that bore out over time, because many, even some fans kind of went by the wayside after Seventh Son, And, you know, they kind of started to listen again around X Factor time.
Yeah, I love Seventh Son, but definitely there, it seems like there were maybe some uninspired moments on those last two Bruce albums. And there was starting to be more and more of a divide between the Bruce songs and the Steve songs, where they almost felt like different bands. Like some of the Bruce songs barely even felt like Iron Maiden songs anymore. Of course, Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter started as a Bruce solo song. And I think the X Factor definitely did feel like it was more of a return to a classic, epic, serious kind of Iron Maiden album. But obviously with Bruce gone, Steve just really took the reins, right? I mean, that was recorded at his home studio and he produced it and everything.
Yeah, well, before the album before that was still recorded at Steve's home, but that was used in a mobile studio parked outside the back there. Uh-huh. And then Steve equipped his own studio to record the X Factor album, and we did it there. And that was it. And Steve was going through a lot of personal stuff at the time. Darkness of that album is actually a reflection of Steve's soul and his heart and the horrible things that he was going through in his life. You know, the band that he'd started from school, people were saying, well, the band will never survive without Bruce. And he had problems in his personal life at the time. All this came around the time of the X Factor, and I think that's reflected in the music and many of the lyrics on the album. I think that is why it is so dark. And I remember being in the studio and reading some interviews with Bruce Dickinson, who I'll say right here is someone who has supported me and only been generous and kind to me before, during and after Iron Maiden. So he's somebody, you know, I have a complete respect for, and I do count him as a friend. But we saw interviews where, and some of the things that Bruce said were so hurtful to disregard for the legacy of Iron Maiden that they'd created. And I think Bruce, reading those things and looking back, I think Bruce was in a very bad place at that time. a very bad place. Yeah. And I think this was this whole era that the X Factor came out of. And we'd read these things, and I'd say to Steve, Doug, that's just not right, mate. Just, you know, absolutely, you've just got to stick with it, stick with it. Come on, we're going to do this. This is going to work. And then, when you know, you'd hear Sign of the Cross when he came into rehearsals with that. And it was just, well, yeah, this is going to be ultimate. This is going to be a classic Maiden song. And when we had Man on the Edge all finished up, you think, yeah, this is going to be great. And, you know, when he came in with Lord of the Flies and things like this that we'd collaborated on, it, you started to get the feel that, yeah, we've got something on this album that perhaps wasn't musically and spiritually perhaps is a step up from the last couple with Bruce. And, well, that's what I believed. And there's so much great music on there.
Yeah, the split with Bruce in the end was, it seems like it was very difficult and just sad. Do you think that Bruce was maybe going through what they call a midlife crisis? Maybe that's what was going on.
I know that, I think Bruce certainly went through a crisis, but whether it's a midlife crisis, you know, where you question your whole thing, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I'm one of three people in the world, and Bruce and I, we don't even say this to each other because we know it. We just smile at each other when we meet a lot of the time. One of three people in the world who know how tough that job is. And Bruce Dickinson been doing that job for a very long time, working absolutely at the top. You are, it's like, it's not just that you're playing the sport. In sporting terms, if you're playing soccer, there and you were playing for an amateur team, then you are in the top professional team, then you're playing for your country, and you're playing for your country every single night, and you're expected to win. And that's a lot of pressure. And the how full the days are, the intensity of the press, the interviews and everything, it's incredible that to go through that. And I think to be at that level for so long is very, very difficult. And I think if Bruce, if he was going through, you know, some kind of crisis, it can only have been amplified 100-fold by being in one of the world's most famous heavy metal bands.
Yeah.
With so much expectation from everybody all of the time. And I think that's a very difficult a very difficult thing, but I think he's always done his best from the point of view of where he was mentally and spiritually, you know, where he was in his life, how he could the best he's always done the best he could do, whether at that time, whether that's the, you know, when he did Brave New World, he proved that, yeah, he could still deliver incredible vocal performances, still do absolutely top-notch recordings. And I think he laid any rumour of that to rest. And his solo album stood up, I think, really well, the work he did on his own. But I think it was a crisis for that everybody was going through in the band. You know, when after the X Factor, I remember talking to Rod Smallwood, and we were in a taxi somewhere, and I said to Rod, I said, I'll tell you what's going to happen to Maiden, is Maiden have to become the next Pink Floyd. Every show has to be big. It has to be done on the biggest scale, and every show has to be an event. I said, that's not what I want for the band, because I love where we are and I love these gigs, but I know that when I meet the fans and when I talk to the fans, I know that is just the natural evolution of Iron Maiden, is to become a stadium band. And those are the gigs that they do. And that's what's happened.
Right. Probably the thing that really sets the X Factor apart, or one of the most interesting things about it, is just how most of the lyrics seem really personal and introspective, which isn't really how Steve Harris wrote lyrics previous to that, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a really good thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that kind of shook people a little bit. But it also, as much as it shook people and some people didn't like it, it also got a lot of other people so into it that people say to me, the X Factor saved my life. The X Factor was a song that got me through a difficult time in my life. I have so many fans come up to me and say that. They say that Virtual Eleven is a really great album, but the X Factor is the one that people say. Listening to that album when I was, you know, had tough times at college, or when I was grieving for my parent dying, or lots of really horrible stuff that people have to go through, people say, the X Factor got me through it. It's an album that's so close to my heart. And I think that's such a fantastic feeling, that you feel that your music has gone beyond just entertainment and it's actually helped somebody. It's because it's come from your heart with a bitter honesty that it's actually been able to really touch another person. That is, to me, is a really incredible feeling. And I think it's something that Steve certainly, I don't think he predicted that.
But that's basically what the record was for Steve too, right? Is it got him through a very difficult time.
Yes, yeah, because those were dark days. And make no mistake about that. It was a very dark time.
Do you think, though, that maybe, you know, the X Factor, most of it, it's long songs, which, of course, Iron Maiden always did long songs, but it's mostly slow and dark. Do you think maybe it needed maybe one or two more upbeat or up-tempo kind of Iron Maiden songs?
I think it is what it is, from where we were. You know, we didn't do too many rehearsals. When we finished the songs, we'd kind of beat them into shape and then, okay, let's record it, which I wasn't used to that. I'm used to rehearsing something and rehearsing it until you really know it and you can get a feeling out of it. But, of course, they've been recording for so long. They know themselves. They know the band. The lineup's been together. It's second nature to them. So that's what happened. And I think it is what it is. It's of its time and it's of its era that it is that way. And I think looking back, when people go back and discover the X Factor as one of the albums, they like people who are getting in to the band post Brave New World, then when they go back and discover the X Factor, then it's a revelation for them. It's like, well, this is so different. And I signed so many copies of that album, new copies, from younger fans or people who are getting into that and have never seen me perform with Iron Maiden. I saw so many copies of The X Factor. People still love that album.
Yeah, there's a lot of great moments on it, and definitely, you know, it suffered from the time it came out and everything, but, you know, it holds up, and in retrospect, when you go back and listen to it now, you listen to it from a totally different perspective from when it first came out, and yeah, so I think... But then, you know, Virtual 11, right away it kicks off with Future Real, which is kind of that galloping Iron Maiden song that wasn't on the X Factor, you know?
What you feel, can you feel? Can you believe what you see?
Can you believe what you feel?
Can you believe what is real? Future real. What is real? Future real. What is real? Future real. What is real? Future real.
Yeah, but, well, things had brightened up because,
yeah,
you know, we'd completed a really long tour in difficult circumstances. We'd come through it. The band hadn't died. We were just as big in Europe as Iron Maiden had ever been. We were bigger in Scandinavia. And, you know, we'd managed to complete a US tour. And we'd be, so we'd done well in South America. And I think, you know, there was a lot of confidence.
Well, and I'm guessing it feels like you had more creative input on Virtual 11 than on the X Factor. Is that true, or?
It was the same on both, really. I had a lot of songs on X Factor, and with Virtual 11, I wrote with Steve a lot. Yeah, when I joined the band, there was no music at all written, nothing.
Okay. Okay.
So it wasn't like I came in and had to adapt to some things that Steve had done for Bruce. They had nothing.
Right.
And we started from scratch with the X Factor, and we had a good vibe. I loved working with Steve. He taught me so much. He was so generous. He gave me so much advice. He was a real mentor to me. And some of the things that I'd questioned about my writing before, he gave me the confidence. He's, no, that's right, yeah, do it like that. You haven't got to have this, you haven't got to have that. You could do it like that. And in other things, where you go, no, try this. You see, this is the way these things work best. This is the way this goes best. And he gave me so much confidence. It was unreal. So I had a lot of ideas ready to go for Virtual 11. And the writing time that we had on that, we had just had some great things. So, yeah, it was just less of my songs actually got on the album for Virtual 11. But we had, you know, we had worked on songs together. But it was great. The writing, that was the thing that I absolutely loved. That's my favourite part of the process, is going from the raw idea into a finished song is my favourite part, really. So, and of course, there's this huge amount of satisfaction that when you get out live and you see people singing along to the songs that you've written, that is just well, for me as an artist and someone who's tried so long to make my mark in the music business, it's an incredible feeling, absolutely incredible. And it feels like a real gift.
That's great. And Virtual 11, it really does kind of it shows how dark the times were when the X Factor was made, because you can feel, I mean, you could feel on the record that this is a happier, you know, moved past the dark times of the X Factor. And, you know, I've read Steve say that it wasn't a conscious thing to shift away from the X Factor; it was just a natural progression. And you know that that seems perfectly believable. You can just feel it. The differences between the albums is just because of the differences in the people making the records, I guess, right? Or the different time in your lives.
Yeah, you see, I felt there was a real optimism around Virtual 11. You know, that we knew we were going to survive. We knew we could do it. And I really felt like, okay, we're gonna do this album the best we can. And this is a real step towards showing the fans that I'm the right choice to be in this band.
But then, Bruce comes back and Adrian comes back. And so I was going to ask you, was there a process to that or was it a shock?
No, it was a complete shock.
Really?
It was, yeah, there were rumors on the internet and on the forum and stuff like that. But I never saw those rumours because I really didn't give a shit about the internet at the time. I didn't have a laptop. It was very difficult to get online when you're away from home. Everything was dial-up then. There was no broadband. So I wasn't really on the internet hardly at all. I never bothered reading the forums or anything like that. So when it came to it and they said, you're out, it was a body blow. really, to me. It just knocked me down, man. And I got up quickly and said, right, I'm going to put my own band together. Steve said, come on, you've got to try and bounce back from this. And he said, you know, try and get yourself together. And Andy Taylor, part of the management, said, look, if you get your album out quickly, you can capitalize on your Iron Maiden fame that you've got now. And so those are things I tried to do. I didn't realise, you know, I got up quickly and I carried on and all of that, but I didn't realise, man, the grief that I had. It took 4 years, really, for me to come to terms with what had happened, because I just put my whole life into that band, and I really absolutely believed that the third album was going to be the one that the fans would go, actually, I like this just as much as the Bruce era, and Resistance would have gone, and I really think that we would have had songs on that third album that people would go, wow, Maiden have still got it, and they've got it with Blaze. So I felt my future, the future that I thought I would have, and the dream that I spent my whole life building towards, a dream of being in a band, on doing a world tour and everything, all of that was just snatched away. And it took really 4 years to understand what had happened to me and come to terms with it. I still kept working, I still kept trying to make music and everything, but that's what it took to realise, you know. And then once I did grieve, once I did get through that process and I grieved for that loss of that future, then I was able to start moving on and start, you know, doing making more of a success of my solo career.
Was there anything on Brave New World that you had been working on with the band?
Yeah, there was a few. I don't know if I'm supposed to talk about it or not. I don't remember that being part of the agreement, but there was a few songs that Steve and I had worked on together that were really strong. And Steve said, I really want to buy these songs off you. And I'll buy them off you. So that's a little bit of extra money for you as well, leaving the band. You've got a bit of extra money to keep yourself going. But, you know, I think these things are really good. And when we worked on them together, you know, there was that edge that you could think, oh, I can't wait to do this live. You know, this is going to be great live. And so they kept those songs. I think it was four songs that we worked on together.
Wow.
One of them. Yeah. And Brave New World is just, it is a really strong album. It's great.
It
sounds great.
Yeah.
And everything. The one that killed me wasn't one of the songs that I worked on. Hearing Bruce singing some of the lyrics that I'd written and melodies that I'd worked on with Steve, to me, that was really cool. That was great. That just meant that I was a valid songwriter, and it gave me confidence to think, no, I am good. I am good enough. Just because I'm not in Iron Maiden doesn't mean I'm not good enough. It just means nobody really knows about me, or I haven't found my audience yet. But the one that really killed me was Blood Brothers, because Steve had shown me that idea, and I'd sang it a little bit along with him acoustically, and I was really looking forward to recording that song. And of course, I never got the opportunity to do it. And when I heard Blood Brothers, Bruce singing Blood Brothers on that album, Brave New World, that's the one that doubled me up, man, and killed me. That's the one I just broke down in tears. That's the one that was the knife in the heart, really. That's the one that hurt the most when I heard Bruce singing Blood Brothers. It was just, it killed me, because that's when I felt like, I really felt like I should have sung that song in the studio. I really felt like I should have recorded that song. And it really killed me. Of course, it's fantastic. Bruce did an absolutely brilliant job of Blood Brothers, and it's become another Iron Maiden classic, another standard. You know, it's become absolutely brilliant. But as time has gone on, I work with a guy called Thomas Svensson, who uses classical guitar, and my feelings have, you know, has become a lot more easy and not so extreme, and I don't feel the pain as much. Then I heard Thomas Svensson do it in his live set acoustic on his classical guitar, and I said, Tom, would you mind putting that in the right key for me? I'd love to have a go at singing that. And so I did, and man, I was crying when I sang it. But after that first time, and I got through that, then I really got into it. And we've recorded our own version now, Blood Brothers, acoustically, and it's on Thomas Vincent's album.
And if you're taking a walk through the garden of life, what do you think you'd expect you would see? Just like a mirror reflecting the moves of your life, and in the river reflections of me. Just for a second, a glimpse of my father I see, and in a movement he beckons to me. And in a moment, the memories are all that remain, and all the wounds are reopening again. We're blood brothers. We're blood brothers. We're blood brothers. We're blood brothers. And as you look all around at the world in dismay, what do you see? Do you think we have learned? Not if you're taking a look at the war torn affray. Out on the streets where the babies are burned. We're blood brothers. We're blood brothers. We're blood brothers. We're blood brothers. Times when I feel I'm afraid for the world. There are times I'm ashamed of us all. When you're floating on all the emotion you feel and reflecting the good and the bad. Will we ever know what the answer to life really is? Can you really tell me what life is? Maybe all the things that you know that are precious to you could be swept away by fate's own hand. We're blood brothers. We're blood brothers. We're blood brothers. We're blood brothers. Chances and a chance to make everything right. Keep on making the same old mistake. Makes untipping the balance so easy. When we're living our lives on the edge, say our prayer on the book of the if you're taking a walk through.
Thank you so much, Blaze.
All right, mate. Lovely talking to you.
Awesome. What a nice guy. I really want to thank Blaze Bailey again for talking to me and telling his story of his time in Iron Maiden. I'm sure you enjoyed that. That was a very cool conversation. So, since he left Iron Maiden, Blaze Bailey has put out 7 albums as either Blaze or Blaze Bailey and a couple of Wolfsbane reunion albums. He's done a lot, and a lot of his stuff, the Blaze solo stuff, is very heavy in the sort of the power metal genre, I guess, a lot of it. There's a lot of really cool stuff. I picked one of my favorites here, I guess, to play at the end of the episode, so I'll just say, and now, to play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
So Blaze, I guess, is going to have a new album coming in March. But right now, let's hear a song from his 2010 Blaze Bailey solo album. The album's called Promise and Terror. And this is a very cool song from that record by Blaze Bailey. It's called Time to Dare. Till next time.
Something is happening that I
after night, there's something haunting me.
Back.